versus the City of Bryan. We have several recusals on this case, sitting for Justice Cook at the end, Judge Young from the 12th District, sitting for Chief Justice Moyer, is Judge Gwynn from the 5th District, sitting for Justice Douglas, is Judge Hadley from the 3rd District, and sitting for Justice Resnick is Judge O'Neill from the 11th District. This is, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mary Ann Whipple on behalf of Appellant the Toledo Edison Company. I'm here with co-counsel Michael Blighty and counsel Paul Roxon, who's counsel for the amici that are supporting Toledo Edison's position in this case. Pursuant to permission previously granted, I'm going to try and share up to 5 minutes of my time with Attorney Roxon. I would also like to reserve 3 minutes for response.
Watch your time.
Thank you. In this case, we have four municipalities that have joined together to supply Chase Brass & Copper Company, a large industrial electric power consumer located far outside the boundaries of any of the municipalities, and that was a customer that Toledo Edison has long served. The municipalities enacted ordinances, entered into contracts to buy electricity and transmission services just to supply non-inhabitant Chase Brass & Copper Company. No inhabitants within any of their municipal boundaries are supplied, or involved in this case at all. The municipality's purchases of transmission services and electricity are directly tied only to supplying Chase Brass & Copper. Two real issues stand out from all of the extensive briefing that's been done in this case. First, what is surplus in Article 18, Section 6 of the Constitution, one of the Home Rule Amendments from 1912? And second, does Section 6 stand wholly apart from Section 4 as an independent grant of authority that the appellees assert, or must Section 6 be interpreted in light of and in conjunction with Section 4 that Toledo Edison asserts? I think the correct constitutional path for this court is illuminated by looking at both sides of the Chase Brass and Copper transactions in this case, the acquisition side, acquiring the power of the transmission services, and the sales side, disposing of it to Chase Brass and Copper. From the standpoint of the acquisition side, Section 4 governs municipal acquisitions of public utilities and public utility products, but it expressly authorizes acquisitions only to serve inhabitants. So what is the authority for acquisitions, the purpose of which is only to supply a customer outside of boundaries? Municipalities try and get around that plain text by arguing that you don't even need to look at Section 4. Whatever they need to do to supply extraterritorial customer Chase Brass and Copper, they say, is inferred from Section 6's limited grant of authority to sell public utility products to others. That's asking this court to make the incongruous holding that while people of the state of Ohio thought that they needed to expressly grant municipalities the power to contract for public utility products and services to supply their own inhabitants in Section 4, they were content merely to imply that authority to acquire products to supply non-inhabitants in Section 6.
Counsel, let me ask you a question if I may. You seem to be concerned with the municipality borders. Is there any legal significance to be attached to the fact that Holiday City incorporated during the pendency of this litigation and the fact that it went out on 12b-6?
Your Honor, I'll take that in two parts. And not on this record. As you correctly observed, this case is here on a motion to dismiss and based on the pleadings that are here. Holiday City, as a matter of published opinion, was permitted to be incorporated, but on this record, it's not clear whether it's been incorporated, and it's not clear what effect, if any, not known as a matter of this record, what effect, if any, that incorporation has had on the existing arrangements or on the service to Chase Brass and Copper Company.
Well, that's the purpose of my question, because it seems to me a legal issue has arisen. You've got a trial court that throws it out on 12B, and then a court of appeals that goes ahead and rules on the merits. Isn't that a problem?
For the purposes of whether a claim has been stated at all, the court of appeals decision is that there's no set of facts that we've expressed that can justify any kind of a claim. And if I may say so, a motion to dismiss was pending here for darn near 3 years. And so a lot may very well have happened in that 3-year period of time. But that indicates that we need to go back to the trial court, as we are on the 50% test already, and we can find out what the facts are. But on the facts that are in this record, this is certainly a live issue and one that I think needs to be decided by this court, both for purposes of guidance of the trial court and the application of the 50% test, and you know, from the larger standpoint of guidance to both my client and the municipalities that are involved here and others like them. In addition to the textual strain, I think that ignoring Section 4 here it imposes upon us, I think that kind of an argument also runs afoul of the case of Britt versus the City of Columbus, where this court has refused to use Section 6 to infer authority that wasn't expressly granted with respect to extraterritorial municipal supply of public utility products. Turning now to the disposition side of these contracts, the cornerstone of the municipality's arguments really seems to be that whatever a private business enterprise can do, a municipality can do. And while that may be true inside the municipal boundaries, it's not so outside. All of the cases cited and the broad language quoted therefrom by the municipalities for the purpose or the proposition that there are boundless proprietary powers are actually Section 4 cases that involve activity in supply within boundaries, not extraterritorial activity. And I think quite tellingly, the two Ohio Supreme Court cases that do involve extraterritorial supply, and that would be Britt and Wilson versus Ant, are in very strange fashion attempted to be distinguished or worse yet ignored. In these cases, I think this court interpreted Section 4 and Section 6 in a plain and straightforward manner, and in viewed with some disfavor a convoluted scheme in Wilson versus Ant to evade the text and the intent of the Home Rule Amendments. And that's really what we're asking this court to do today. Wilson really couldn't be clearer that the purpose of the Home Rule Amendments is emphatically not to enable municipalities to go into general business in competition with private business outside of the boundaries, as they are here with respect to Toledo Edison and former customer Chase Preston Copper. With respect to surplus, the municipalities essentially argue that there's only one limit in Section 6, the numerical 50% test, and essentially reduce surplus to the so-called benchmark that's subsumed within that numerical limit. In other words, surplus is being tautologically defined as anything less than 50%. Well, there's another immediate textual problem. In 1959, Section 6 was amended to explicitly accept water and sewer services from the 50% test. If surplus wasn't separate, there would have been no need to just accept the water and sewer from the 50% test. You have just accepted it from the amendment. Also, based on the interpretation of the municipalities and the Federal District Court in the City of Cleveland case, upon which the municipalities and the Court of Appeals relied so heavily, you don't even need the word surplus anywhere in the Constitution. The Section 6 would read the same, and the same exact arguments could be made if the word surplus wasn't there, as are being made now. To coin a phrase, municipalities are, in effect, making the word surplus mere surplus this year. And that's contrary to basic principles of constitutional interpretation and the case law that says there are two limits and they're to be strictly construed at that.
Counsel, would this dispute be mooted at all by the change, I don't know if they're law now or not,
the regulation and restructuring?
Right.
No, Your Honor, and I think Mr. Ruxington addressed that in a little bit more detail, but Senate Bill 3 is intended to promote competition in the generation market, in its markets, and it's not going to do anything to change the constitutional limits that are on municipalities
affected by that legislation?
There are some things that they can do under Senate Bill 3, but those things are not directly implicated or won't, I think, really be implicated by the outcome of this case. I'd like to leave a little bit of time for Mr. Ruxin before I sit down. I think we need to ask, what is surplus? Surplus in relation to what? And I think it's surplus over the used to supply inhabitants in Section 4. Surplus has some substantive constitutional meaning that every word of the Constitution is supposed to have if it's a leftover incidental to supply to inhabitants under Section 4. And notwithstanding all of the dire and somewhat complicated hypotheticals that are spun by the municipalities in their brief, it's really a simple test to apply in this case on these facts. The purpose, the sole purpose of the purchase of electricity and the transmission capacity and the line here was to serve a non-inhabitant Chase, Brass, and Copper. It's not leftover residue connected in any way or incidental to supplying inhabitants in this particular case. I'd like to leave a couple of minutes of my time for co-counsel for the MPs.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Paul Ruxton. James Boyd White, who is a distinguished professor at the University of Michigan in Oswald, had written a wonderful book called When Words Lose Their Meaning. It's a useful book for all lawyers in all courts. And this case is a wonderful example of how it applies, because the case is about whether words have meaning. And it's important because law has at least two functions that concern us as lawyers. The first is predictive, and the second is directive. As a lawyer, I have always tried to counsel my clients about what a statute means. And I've never claimed I've always been right about that, but I know I've always applied one principle.
Well, what are the critical words that lost meaning, and what meaning should they have?
And the critical words here are surplus product.
And what is the meaning that you prescribe to that term?
With respect to a sale can only be of something that one possesses. If you are a municipality, you may only possess power to sell if you acquired it for the purpose of serving your inhabitants. Therefore, the word surplus product, to have any meaning at all in Section 6, must refer to surplus over the amount acquired, and it can only be acquired for the limited purpose of serving
your inhabitants. Well, if you're a municipality and you join other municipalities and you build or buy a large generation facility, and that facility exceeds the needs of your members when you acquire it, but would service those needs, projected growth and all of that 5, 10, 15 years down the road, would the excess capacity that you achieve when you buy that to serve your municipalities and to serve their foreseeable future needs at the same time, with that excess capacity be surplus?
Just like in my opinion, the capacity that is acquired to serve inhabitants can be used up to 50% of the amount that serve you inhabitants to sell elsewhere. That is surplus product. On the other hand, the record in this case must be taken as pledged. It's on a motion to dismiss. It is clear that this capacity was not acquired to serve the inhabitants of any of these communities.
How is that clear? How is that clear by this record? As an example, if you've got four municipalities and they buy X amount of power and they get a better rate if they buy more than if they buy less, how do we know from this record whether or not that was what was happening?
Judge, I think it's clear from the contractual record below that the negotiations were involved, the course of conduct of the parties made clear that this capacity was acquired specifically to use a certain transmission line to be delivered to Chase Brassica. I don't think there's much dispute about that on the record here, but it must be assumed as true.
Well, is there going to have to be an investigation every time there's a sale made by a municipality? And is there going to have to be a court hearing to determine the intent then of the sale every time there is one?
Judge Hattie, in my opinion, no, and that brings me back to both the predictive and the directive value of law. If this case clearly asserts the product, stands for the proposition that surplus product must be product in excess of that acquired to serve the inhabitants, once that principle is established, I trust that the governmental units of the state of Ohio will observe the law, and it won't be necessary to test each one of them each time. Certainly, you can rely on fines like mine to be the police, the court of the
And if we give the word meaning, you say they have had and should continue to have, what happens to this case? It goes where?
Well, I think the case goes back
to then develop
to develop a factual basis.
Factual record.
Yes, whether this was in fact acquired for the purpose, how it was acquired for the purpose of serving the inhabitants.
But I thought you just said that was established.
Well, it's established in the motion to dismiss, but if it goes back to trial, I think then we could certainly be able to approve. Your Honor, I think, let me conclude, I know the time is nearly up to say that. I've been able to advise my clients because I know how to read a statute in order to try to give meaning to every word. What I don't know, what no lawyer can ever know, is what words to ignore, if that isn't the rule. And in reading Section 6 of Article 18 and Section 4 of Article 18, I can only advise clients, any lawyer can only advise clients, if the lawyer struggles to give meaning to each of the words in context, because it's impossible to know in advance which words don't count and which words don't matter.
Thank you, Counsel. Good morning, Your Honor. Justices, visiting judges, Ms. Whipple, Ms. Biting, Ms. Roxon. May it please the Court, my name is John Coyle, firm Duncan Allen, Washington, D.C., hearing today for Ohio Beachy. I have two brief preliminary matters this morning. First, I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for some of the permission granted, I believe, for Mr. Sheldon Gaft to present argument on behalf of the amici supporting the firmness.
Yes. You have to watch your time.
I shall. Thank you. The other thing I would like to do is to acknowledge the presence here in the courtroom, of Mr. Stephen Kaster, Director of Utilities of City of Ryan Municipal Light and Water Utilities, Mr. Dale Matthews, Village Administrator of the Village of Edgerton, Mr. John Bittler, the Village Administrator of the Village of Montpelier, and Mr. Michael Nagy, Village Administrator of the Village of Pioneer. We introduce council papers to my immediate left, John Benteen, Justin Wilcox, and Zachary, Mr. Pat, who I believe is known to you, Mr. Zoll, of Zoll and Kranz, for Amicus Chase Brass, and in fact, retired Justice Craig Wright, who's familiar to. Toledo Edison attempts.
Sometimes when patients come here, they're often gray. It could be one reason to be impressed, it could be the other reason to be equally impressed. A lot of them go with the meaning of a word. I came across one sentence in one of the meters briefs that seemed to crystallize for me, so I want to hear your best argument against it. And it says that the purchaser inadvertently buys somewhat more than needed. The leftover then is indeed surplus, which is a commonly accepted meaning of word. But an adequately provided for purchaser who goes out and buys more, specifically intending to resell it to others, that he bought surplus, but he has bought inventory and ventured into the commodity business. That to me sums up what we're really arguing about. So I'd like to hear your best argument by why that is not so.
That's fair. I think when you're confronted with an issue of constitutional interpretation like this, there are three things that you have to look at. First, obviously, you have to look at the text of the Constitution. Then you look at the constitutional debates to the extent that they're enlightening. Then you look at the case law. In this case, the language of the Constitution itself does not lend itself to that interpretation of the meaning of the word surplus. Let me explain, because you do have to appreciate Article 18, Section 6 in a context that involves Article 18, Section 4. The relationship is not as inextricable, in our view, as Toledo Edison says it is. Perhaps if it would assist the court, the second page of the appendix to the municipality's brief contains the text of Article 18, Section 6. And I have it in front of you while I do this. The first word that you come to that I submit is relevance to answering Justice Lindbergh Stratton's question is the word also. Okay? Any municipality that owns or operates a public utility, which tells you who's able to make extraterritorial sales. You can't make extraterritorial sales if you're not in the utility business. So you have to own and operate a utility in the first place. May also, and that is, you being granted by Section 6 a power in addition to that is granted by Section 4. Sell and deliver unto others the surplus product of any other utility. I'm eliding a couple of words because it deals with transportation service. The question is surplus product, not surplus capacity, and that's an important distinction. The reason for the distinction is, as this court has previously held in State X Rel Wilson v. Hans, the quantitative limit on extraterritorial sales that's imposed by Article 18, Section 6 is to be measured in terms of what is supplied within the municipality.
Okay. Well, let me stop you there if I may, sure. Because I'd like to crystallize the question that's on the table.
Okay.
If we're looking at surplus,
right,
defining whether it's surplus product or, as the judge suggested, municipalities venturing into the commodity market. If we were to accept your argument, could not the Ohio Municipal League band together and say that which we supply to our customers is X, and 50% of X that we're going to buy from Mexico is now available for sale to others? Would they not?
Not the Municipal League, Your
Honor. Why not?
The Municipal League does not.
We'll get all the cities together and they're just going to say, we're just going to be the Ohio electrical cities.
That would not be the Municipal League.
Okay,
you
take that away.
To follow through your hypothetical, you could theoretically have an aggregation of municipalities, did you have one in this case, that have pooled a resource to make an extraterritorial sale.
Now, what's the resource? What's the resource there? What's the resource they're pooling?
Purchase power. That's the issue that's in front of you. Okay. They pooled the resource to make an extraterritorial sale. And to define surplus in that context, let me see if I can get right to the nub of it for you. Toledo Edison defines surplus with reference to Section 4. Okay? And Toledo Edison's argument is that you can only understand the meaning of the word surplus in the phrase that you quoted me, Justice Lindbergh Stratton, adopts that definition of surplus. Right? There is a different definition of surplus which is more contextually suitable to what Article 18, Section 6 means. And surplus, as we understand the word, means surplus to what you sell within your corporate limits. Okay? And I think if you think it through, that is a very economical use of the word surplus that's appropriate to constitutional draftsmanship. It is consistent with the text of the remainder of the section.
In this particular case, the appellant in this case has told us that basically the pleadings indicate that no sales of any power are made within any of the municipalities. And that in the context of a motion to dismiss, assuming that to be true, that your definition that you just discussed is not germane to this analysis.
Let me see if I can restate your question a little bit for you, Judge, because I don't think that's quite accurate even as to what Toledo Edison told you, which in turn is not quite accurate as to what the complaint shows. All right? What Toledo Edison has told you is that these municipalities made a special purchase of electricity in order to serve an extraterritorial customer. They also sell and deliver electric power within their corporate limits. They own their own utilities. So that in this context, there is an extra increment of power that's purchased, but they have not, they all own and operate utilities and provide service within their corporate limits. That's number one, all right? Second, the record also shows, and when I say the record, I mean the attachments to Toledo Edison's complaint as they appear in Toledo Edison's supplement, which is part of the complaint under Civil Rule 10C, okay? There's an indication that what then happened when the municipalities purchased this additional increment of power to facilitate the sale of Chase Brad, power was blended with other power resources that they had, okay? And that enabled the municipalities, or some of them, to reduce rates to their own customers. were made to lower the cost of serving their own customers. I don't believe there's actually any indication of rate reduction. But to lower the cost of serving their own customers as well as to supply the lower cost of serving Chase Brass. We took that as a hypothetical in our brief that takes that so much further, but
I guess what I'm indicating is that it was my understanding, based on not only the written material, but the oral representations here today, and that none of the, in this case, they say that the selling, none of the municipal contracts with AMP involved in this case were for the purpose of selling power to the municipal inhabitants or supplying the municipality's own needs. They say specifically the only purpose in purchasing this power was to resell it to Chase Brass.
That is what the text of the complaint alleges, and what I'm suggesting to you is that the ordinances and contracts that are appended to the complaint and that are part thereof under Civil Rule 10C tell a somewhat different story. Although you can assume...
Well, but we're here under a 12B6 analysis on a motion to dismiss. And my observations in this area were invited by your comment concerning how you measure surplus. And that is surplus, as you defined it, right here is that amount that is not used within the municipality by its own inhabitants.
Correct.
Okay. But they're telling us in their pleadings that none of the power that's purchased in this particular case is used in the municipality, so therefore there's no benchmark to measure the surplus amount.
All right, so now I understand your question. I think I can answer it a little more succinctly. The way you are supposed to analyze the issue under Article 18, Section 6, is the limit is 50% of the total, okay? And that's the word from the Constitution, 50% of the total product supplied within the municipality. So you don't go purchase by purchase. Figure out whether the municipality is backing it up two-thirds from inside, one-third for outside. The municipality is entitled to sell, okay, up to 50% of what is consumed with inside the corporate limits, outside the corporate limits. That's the significance of the word surplus, but you don't look at an individual contract. These municipalities are, and it is undisputed as a matter of record here, supplying electric power and energy within their corporate limits. Precise issue of how you actually determine whether they're exceeding the quantitative limit in Article 18, Section 6 is the one issue that was remanded by the Court of Appeals.
Counsel, if I'm understanding your argument correctly, under your theory, they could have done it that way. As long as it remained within the 50% excess of what they use on their own people, they could go out and they could buy specifically to resell. As long as it's less than 50%. That is the natural extension of what you are asking
for. I don't think it's an extension. I think that's exactly our position.
So under your theory, and, no matter where you get it from, no matter what reason you buy it for, as long as you keep to the limit of 50% of what you use for your own territory,
That is our position, Your Honor. That is what's supported by the text of the Constitution, and that is what's supported by the legislative, by the constitutional proceedings.
So in your book, it doesn't matter whether they bought it specifically to resell it, then that, as long as it's less than 50%.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct.
Counsel, whose surplus are we talking about in the Constitution? When the Constitution refers to a surplus, what surplus is that?
This is the surplus of a municipality owning or operating a public utility for purposes of supplying the product thereof to its inhabitants. If I could be allowed to lie a few words from the Constitution, I think that preserves the sense of it. Okay. The municipality has the right to sell a surplus, constitutionally defined as up to 50% of what it sells. Therefore, what is consumed within its corporate limits.
Doesn't that mean that the amount of electricity that they thought would be necessary for their municipality and the customers in the city, that it's over that amount that they thought they would need if they had some left over? So then the leftover or surplusage can then be sold to outside sources?
Justice Sweeney, the Constitution does not define the term with reference to the municipality's expectations, whether their beliefs or their flaws. It defines it in strict quantitative terms, 50% of the total product supplied within the municipality. If the court would indulge me, I notice the white light's on, and I'd like to preserve a balance of my time.
Fine.
Thank you.
Yes.